Well, we are continuing our series, but believe it or not, this is our last week in the Sermon on the Mount. And I have to say, I actually feel a little bit sad about it. I don't know about you, but I have really enjoyed working through this most famous sermon from Jesus. I think at the same time, though, I have to tell you that as I sat down to work on this last sermon, I actually kind of started feeling bad about being done with the Sermon on the Mount so soon. I mean, we made it all the way through Jesus' most famous sermon in 9 weeks. I took a semester-long course on this in seminary. The commentaries on my shelf about the Sermon on the Mount are 400 pages long. And I actually started looking around to see how long it took other churches to get through the Sermon on the Mount, and I saw things like 12 weeks, 14 weeks, 20 weeks. We did it in 9. I actually started questioning what we had just done this week. And then I remembered that Jesus went through this most famous sermon in one sitting. This is one sermon, right? And I guarantee you this one sermon is shorter than any 9 of mine. All kidding aside, I think the reality is there's no amount of time or no number of sermons that would ever allow us to mine the full riches of everything that Jesus says in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. I think we should recognize the fact that we should expect to spend time with this sermon for the rest of our lives. That said, we are going to wrap up our series in the Sermon on the Mount today so that we can get ready to turn our attention towards Advent in coming weeks. And so I'm going to invite you to join me in Matthew 7, 21 to 29, which you can find on page 1478 in the Bibles under your seats. We're going to listen in one last time as Jesus tells us what it looks like to follow him and to know him and to love him via what I imagine might be a pretty familiar parable to you that's also paired with a fairly sober warning. I might listen with ends. We read Matthew 7, 21 to 29. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name drive out demons? And in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, so you'll have to forgive me for maybe downplaying that warning. I don't know about you, but when I read verses 21 and 23, I think those are some of the most troubling words in all of Scripture. At the same time, you'll have to maybe forgive me for saving this warning for this last sermon, where we should be wrapping things up nicely with a bow and talking about this beloved parable about building our lives on the rock that is Jesus Christ. The thing is, I actually struggled with where to deal with these words. I kind of wrestled over the last few weeks, and I thought about dealing with it last week because the things that Jesus says here probably aligns with the stuff that he says about discernment, which we looked at in the words right before this. In the end, though, I decided that I thought it might be most helpful to consider this warning today because I think these verses help us, it helps frame the real contrast that Jesus is making in this parable. Believe it or not, I think this parable, Jesus is contrasting not Christians and non-Christians, but actually two kinds of Christians, true Christians and false Christians. Now, we'll need to unpack that idea as we go along, but we're going to start with this warning because if we'll take a deeper look, I think we'll see some really important details that might help us understand this parable all the more. Jesus says, beginning in verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. We're going to leave this here because I want to point out a couple of interesting things. First of all, the fact that Jesus refers to the kingdom of heaven, which Jesus mentions multiple times in the sermon, like in Matthew 5, where he says things like, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Or in Matthew 6, where he tells us to seek first the kingdom of heaven. Secondly, notice that Jesus talks about his Father in heaven, which again points us back to other parts of the sermon, like in Matthew 5, where Jesus tells us to do good things so that other people might glorify our Father in heaven. Or like Matthew 6, where he tells us to pray to our Father in heaven. Thirdly, notice that Jesus calls some people evildoers, which I'm sure you didn't need any help noticing, right? Like that word like jumps off the page, like some other kind of shocking words that Jesus uses in the parable, most notably hypocrites, which he actually uses earlier in Matthew 7. Now, the thing about this word here, evildoers in the Greek, it actually probably more literally could be translated as one who practices lawlessness, which, you know, takes some away some of the sting, just not all of it. Lastly, notice that Jesus talks about prophesying and driving out demons and doing miracles in his name, which the disciples of Jesus very much do later in the story. We see them doing this in the book of Acts. The thing is Jesus doesn't tell us to do those things in the sermon, which may mean those are good things, but they may not be the most important things. More on that in a moment. But I point these things out just to kind of once again remind you, as we've been trying to remind ourselves each week, that the things that Jesus says here are connected to everything else that Jesus says in this one sermon. Like this is a part of the whole package. And one of the things that we've seen in this one sermon in the package is this particular theme where God tells us not to do things to draw attention to ourselves. Like Jesus explicitly tells us that we should not pray or fast or give to get accolades for ourselves, from our peers, but rather to actually commune with God. Now, we're going to spend some time talking about communing with God because that actually is the point of all points in this. But before I do, let's just take a brief moment to talk about those actions that Jesus talks about. That would be, you know, prophesying and driving out demons and doing miracles. Those are all attention-getting actions, aren't they? Right? And for the record, they're actually good actions, right? At least if Jesus is talking about true prophecy rather than false prophecy, like that Jesus literally just warned us about in the words right before today's passage. I'm assuming that Jesus is talking about good prophecy. Speaking about and for God is actually a good thing. So is driving out demons, right? That is literally delivering someone from evil. So is performing miracles. If we're actually offering help and assistance and something is changing the situation for those who are in need, those are good things. These are good deeds. They are righteous actions. The thing is, as Jesus says, that we can do good things like that, and it seems like completely miss the point. Like we can still practice lawlessness, which could lead to us being dismissed as evildoers in the end. Yikes. Like, what do we do with a warning like this? Well, I think we can start by not missing the point of the warning. And I think the point is not that we would live our lives in fear. Like, I don't think Jesus is actually telling us that we should be anxious and worried and afraid for the rest of our lives. How could he when in this very sermon, Jesus literally says not to be anxious about tomorrow, not to worry about what we will eat or drink or wear. Seems really odd to me that Jesus would on the one hand tell us not to worry about the essentials of everyday life and then cause us to worry about the essentials of the afterlife. That is, whether or not we actually know God. I don't think for a minute that Jesus is trying to stoke fear within us. I think instead, Jesus is actually just soberly reminding us not to take a relationship with God for granted. I think he's actually inviting us to assess the state of our souls. Like, what's actually going on in my life? And to reinforce that warning, he shares this beloved parable about building our life on rock rather than on sand. Now, unlike some of Jesus' other parables, you know, those agrarian stories which often need explaining in our app store world, this one needs no explanation, right? This makes sense in every word, every world. If you build your house on sand, there's a good chance that it's going to get washed away. Especially if the climate keeps changing and storms keep worsening, right? The flip side of that is if you build your house on solid rock, your house stands a better chance of weathering those storms. Now, to be clear, Jesus is not guaranteeing us a carefree life, and he's not downplaying the need for insurance. He's calling us to spiritual action. He's actually saying, assess the state of your souls. Don't take a relationship with God for granted. Figure out what's going on. Now, it's with that in mind that I'll remind you that earlier that I did say, I think the real comparison in this passage is not between Christians and non-Christians, but between true Christians and false Christians. I'll double down on that now. I'll also add some caveats so that we can actually consider these words. First of all, let's just acknowledge the fact that the word Christian did not exist when Jesus preached this parable. That's just a helpful way of us thinking back and understanding these words, right? So those categories didn't exist, but the same principle applies. True followers and lovers of God as opposed to false followers and lovers of God. Secondly, the instability that Jesus is warning about, of course this applies to non-Christians as well as false Christians. The fact is, anyone who tries to build their life without God who gives us life, any of us who tries to live our lives without God being involved, the God who gives us and sustains us and is life, we are inevitably going to face spiritual instability, no matter how religious or irreligious we may be. And that's the main point that Jesus is trying to make. He's speaking to the Jews of his day, not to the Roman emperor or the pagan nations around them, but to the Jews of his day who were actually deeply religious in some different ways at times, but deeply religious and deeply, deeply interested in God. And what he's saying to them, and I think what he's saying to us, is you can be as religious as you want and completely miss the point if you don't know God. And if you want to put it in the context of thinking it from a Christian lens, you can refer to Jesus as Lord, but actually reject him as Lord by not following him, but rather just kind of following what everybody else is doing and following the lords of this world. If you do that, if we do that, we prove ourselves to be false Christians, or hypocrites, you might say. This is the word that Jesus used earlier in this chapter. And as we learned a couple of weeks ago, the word hypocrite originally meant an actor, that is, someone who pretends to be something that they aren't. Now, I think a lot of times when we think of the word hypocrite in religious contact, we maybe sometimes accuse people of hypocrisy, we're thinking of people trying to fool other people. But I think what Jesus is saying is don't fool yourself. Don't think you're something when you aren't. Now, I bring that up so that we'll pay attention pretty closely to what Jesus says in the parable. I mean, look again. He says, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. One does what Jesus says, the other doesn't. He just keeps on keeping on until the ground washes out from underneath him. Till catastrophe strikes. Till there's this great crash, is what he says at the end of this chapter. Again, I don't think the point is to cause us to fear. Jesus isn't interested in scaring us into his kingdom. But I think he is once again reminding us not to take a relationship with God for granted. Or to put it actually in the terms that I think we see Jesus speaking to in this passage, this sermon again and again, is to actually pursue a relationship, to seek a relationship, to invest in a relationship, to flourish in a relationship, to actually commune with God. Communing with God is about being in relationship with God. Emphasis on being. I mean, the fact of the matter is, a genuine relationship be it our Father in heaven or anyone here on earth, is built around being, not so much doing. Right? I mean, being in a relationship with someone will change what you do. It will affect the things that we do, but doing is not a relationship, right? Like those of you who are married, you don't do things for your spouse to get them to love you, right? You do things for your spouse or with your spouse because you love them. Or those of us who think about the deep friendships that we have, right? We don't develop deep friendships, you know, by occasionally liking each other's posts online or, you know, checking in once a year on a birthday. Relationships are built around proximity and presence and time. Again, put it in the context of marriage, right? Like, a happy marriage doesn't happen because you do things on a schedule for a relationship. Like, every Friday we go out to dinner. Or, you know what? Twice a year, I bring flowers. And on our anniversary, I do something really big. You know, which would be like the marital equivalent of the things that Jesus talks about. Big things like casting out demons or prophesying. In the same way, like the friends that I've known over the years that I stay in contact with, social media, like I don't think my deepest relationships aren't the ones where we only check in on each other's birthdays. What I'm trying to say is there is an idea of a genuine relationship with God that is similar to any genuine relationship we have on earth, at least the most meaningful relationships. The most meaningful ones. The ones that change what we do with our lives are the ones that are marked by presence, proximity, an investment of time, and really the development of intimacy. In fact, I would say intimacy really is the whole, that's the key word behind this whole section. In fact, if you think back to that warning, when Jesus says, "Depart from me, I never knew you," he isn't saying like, "Hey, who are you? I have no knowledge of you." What he's saying is like, "I have no relationship with you." We don't actually know each other in the most intimate sense. In fact, it might surprise you to hear this, but the word to know in Scripture is often used in intimate ways, both in Greek and in Hebrew. Like, for example, Adam knew his wife and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. Joseph did not know his wife, Mary, until she gave birth to their son, Jesus. Now, if you're wondering how a virgin could give birth to a child, I invite you to join us for our Advent series. We'll be talking about the scandalously good news of Christmas. But if you want to know how to avoid hearing Jesus say to you in the end, "I never knew you," like we have no relationship, then I invite you to take the warning in today's passage seriously. And to take the story behind it seriously. Like none of us should take a relationship with God for granted. Each of us should actually seek to develop and to grow in and to flourish in and to invest in and to receive from an intimate relationship with the God who made us. Which means that as much as Jesus calls us to put his words into practice, it is not a checklist of things to do. It is an invitation to seek God, to talk to him, to listen to him, to spend time with him, to sit with him, to commune with him. The question is, okay, well, how do we do that? It's a $1 million question, right? $1 million question with a Sunday school answer. I mean, it's a Sunday school answer. Like the way that we do that is we actually seek practices of prayer and Scripture. And yes, maybe some other spiritual disciplines. Of course, every time I say the word spiritual disciplines, it sounds more like an exercise routine than a relationship builder. So think of it more like spiritual practices and habits, the same things that we might think of in any relationship. We'll come back to that in a moment. But let's come back to the Sunday school answer of prayer and Scripture. The reason those are the Sunday school answers is because these are the two things that God repeatedly calls us to. He says these are the means by which you can actually interact with a transcendent God who is behind all things and who is before all things and who is actively in the world and who you can't see, but you can absolutely experience. If you look at Scripture, as you look at the course of history, As you look around at the people you're sitting next to now, the people who know God and seek God and are actually in a relationship, what are the things that are essential to their lives? Prayer and Scripture. I mean, these are the tools that the people of God have come to long before we were called Christians. These have been the tools since the very beginning. These are the means by which we actually engage with a transcendent God. And yes, even if we maybe pray different prayers at different times or different styles of prayer, maybe if there are different means by which we tend to resonate with in engaging with Scripture, these are the common things that we keep coming back to. So I'll say this. It's possible to do these things as a checklist. You know what I mean? Like in the same way, like, well, every Friday night I bring flowers, and every year on anniversary we do this. You can get up and say, every morning I pray for 3.5 minutes, and I read a verse of Scripture. Check. You can do these things and still miss the point. But I would also say, the thing to consider is, if these prayer and Scripture aren't a part of your regular rhythm, whatever that rhythm looks like in different seasons of life, it may point to the absence of a relationship, or at least maybe an unhealthy relationship that maybe needs some attention. So consider how these ancient tools and these gifts from God actually might be a means of reinvigorating or reimagining or establishing, it is, a real relationship with the God who made you. Of course, at the same time, I mentioned the idea of spiritual disciplines or practices or habits. I think there are other things that we're called to in Scripture that help maybe reinforce and reinvigorate and help us to take advantage of these things. For example, there are things like fasting, which is mentioned in the Sermon on the Mount, and which is connected to prayer. This practice of actually choosing to give up something so we might give more attention to seeking God. There are things like silence and solitude. These actual things that invite us to sometimes just simply sit with God, to make space just to be present before Him, and sometimes to actually listen for Him rather than doing all the talking, which I don't know about you, but I tend to do that in most of my relationships. There are all sorts of practices. Journaling and confession and worship and Scripture meditation and Scripture memory. There are an abundance of things. And you know what? There are resources that we'll talk about in a moment. Things that actually we can do to help us take advantage of the gift of prayer in Scripture. There are also some habits which can change the way we engage with things. Like, for example, what if we picked up our Bibles before we picked up our phones each day? What do you mean? Not check my email or check the latest headlines or whatever the latest, you know, cabinet appointment is. I got to find out what's going on in the world. Now, what if you actually checked in with God before you checked on everything else? Or you know what? What if in those moments where you get anxious, which, let's be honest, we all do. What if instead of, you know, checking out on Netflix for a while or doom scrolling on social media, or you know, draining some bottle of whatever, what if instead of those coping mechanisms, you actually did something like an ancient practice, like examine, which invites us to kind of stop and ask some reflective questions, like, why am I anxious right now? What's the root of that? What am I angry about? What am I sad about? Where did I, like, miss God today? Where did I blow up that I wish I could redo? Where did God show up? Like, what am I thankful for? What am I happy about? What if you actually, you and I actually ask questions like that rather than just distancing ourselves from the day? Or how about this? What if we took some cues from Gen Z and touched grass, like literally? Like seriously, what if you went outside, made a point to go outside every day? And to take a moment to just recognize the vastness of God's creation. And do something crazy. What if you took off your shoes and you literally stood on the ground outside to remind yourself to be grounded in Him? Like to build your life on a firm foundation. I actually know someone who begins every day that way, rain or shine. Or as they say here in the Pacific Northwest, rain or rain. Now, the thing is, this guy is not Gen Z. He's actually my age. And he says he does this because he realizes he gets lost in all of the digital things that we do, which this guy does for a living. I guess what I would encourage you to recognize at the end of this is there's not really a one-size-fits-all. In other words, you can't say, well, this person's doing that way, so if I just do this, it'll be fine. That's not the point. The idea is that each of us would develop our own relationship, which is going to have some commonalities, but it's also going to be tailored to the ways that we participate in relationships in general. What are the ways that you spend time with and show up in to be really present for? What are the things that you do to develop intimacy in your most meaningful relationships? Begin to imagine what that like might look like in this relationship, which is the most meaningful of all relationships. Relationship with the God who made you and who sent his son for you. Tell you one of the helpful ways to think about it would be the way a man named Sky Gittani thinks of it. Now, Sky Gittani is a guy who wrote a really great book called What If Jesus Was Serious? It's about the Sermon on the Mount, and I wish I had discovered this 9 weeks ago before we started this series. Maybe the series would be better. Who knows? Anyway, before Sky Gittani wrote this book called What If Jesus Was Serious, he actually wrote another book that actually has been a book I've come back to repeatedly. It's a book called With, Reimagining Your Relationship with God. Now, the catch of Sky Gittani's book, this original book that he wrote years ago, is that he uses 5 prepositions to say, hey, here's a way to view the difference between building your life on the rock and building it on sand. Here's the goal, and here are these distortions that religious people and irreligious people sometimes settle for. And he basically says, the goal of the book is to live our life with God, not from God or over God or under God or for God. Now, I'm not going to unpack all of Sky Gittani's words. You can read the book for yourself. And guess what? You can borrow my copy if you want. It's right next to the commentaries on the Sermon on the Mount. They're like 400 pages long. You can also borrow those. So I'm not going to unpack all his ideas, and I'm not going to try to suggest that this book is the end-all, be-all of what a Christian is called to. That book would be the Bible, for the record. And Sky Gittani is just one book that actually gives us maybe a way of assessing where we find ourselves. It's actually one place where you can find some examples of some spiritual practices and habits that might help reinvigorate your life. There are all sorts of other books out there. Maybe they're better. I don't know. Richard Foster has some great ones, and so does Dallas Willard, and so does Thomas, Kempis and Thomas Merton. There's a lot of great stuff out there. I'd be happy to point you to any one of those. Also, I would encourage you to point each other to this. You might have discovered something good that might be meaningful for each other. But as we get ready to wrap up this sermon and to wrap up this series on the most famous sermon there is, the Sermon on the Mount, I want to take a cue from Jesus and end with a parable. And I'm going to cheat a little bit and borrow some words from Sky Gittani. Joel is a middle-aged man with some success at business. He describes himself as a Christian who has a bit of a weakness for alcohol and women and gambling, the latter being why he's talking to a pastor right now. A bad run of bets is now jeopardizing his business. He says, I don't really go to church all that much, but I know right and wrong. I'm concerned that God won't bless my business because of what I've done. I need to make things right with him because I can't afford to have my partners and God against me. Life from God. Mark is an elder at his church who loves to read, and he has read every book there is on leadership. Very clear-eyed, he says, you know what? The problem with churches is they don't understand the basic principles on which every organization rises or falls. Our church will be more successful if we didn't spend so much time sitting around praying. We actually need to learn some lessons from the work world. We need to undo those kind of things. Life over God. Rebecca is a few months away from graduating from a really great Christian college. She's starting to wrestle what to do next. She says, you know, I've always dreamed of going to medical school, and I have the grades to get in. But does the world really need another cardiologist? I want my life to matter more than that. I want to do something really significant, which, you know what? If you're going to do something significant, you got to go into full-time Christian ministry. I think God may be calling me to give up my dream of becoming a doctor so I can actually serve him. Life for God. Karen has a son who struggles with severe depression. And his coping mechanism, his drug abuse, only exacerbates the problem. It leads to more destructive behaviors. It isn't supposed to be this way, she says. We have always honored God in our home. We have always done the right thing. We even have a verse from Proverbs hanging in our house. Raise up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Why is it happening this way? Why is God punishing us? Life under God. Be still and know that I am God. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Come to me, all you who are wearied and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon me, you, and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and my burden is light. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened. Life with God. Which way of life do you want? What kind of practices and opportunities and habits might actually help you grow in that?